Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The United States Postal Service is America's favorite federal agency. That's according to Gallup. Their most recent poll back in 2019 found that 74% of Americans viewed the Postal Service's job performance as excellent or good. Now, over the course of the pandemic, the Postal Service proved how essential its services actually are, delivering 320 million COVID-19 test kits and helping more than 40% of American voters vote by mail in the 2020 presidential election. Also in the summer of 2020, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a prolific donor to the Trump campaign, announced sweeping changes to the Postal Service, including ousting or reassigning 23 senior leaders, removing more than 600 mail sorting machines, and hundreds more mail collection boxes nationwide. The changes resulted in severe mail delays in many states, though DeJoy defended the massive cost-cutting measures as necessary to achieve, quote, significant reforms of the agency's, quote, dire financial issues. And what exactly are those financial issues? Well, as the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported, the USPS's expenses exceeded revenues by $18 billion in 2020 as its labor compensation costs continued to increase while the volume of its most profitable mail products continued to decline. The Postal Service is not financially sustainable, and congressional action is essential to reforming the USPS's business model, end quote. That was from the GAO. Well, the House and Senate listened. Or more importantly, lawmakers likely listened to the tens of millions of Americans who rely on the unique service provided by the post office. So in April of this year, Congress passed the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022. President Biden signed it into law, the biggest reform of the agency since 2006.
Today, we enshrine in law our recognition that the Postal Service is fundamental to our economy, to our democracy, to our health, and the very sense of who we are as a nation. And this bill recognizes the Postal Service as a public service, and we're ensuring that it can continue to serve all Americans for generations to come.
So here's a moment where we want to focus on an actual solution. Congress has stepped up and has made an effort to shore up the Postal Service. So what does the new law accomplish? What holes remain? And will the USPS be a viable public agency long into the future? Or is there still an argument for privatization of America's most trusted federal agency? That's what we're going to look at today. And joining us now is Jacob Bogage. He's reporter for The Washington Post, covering business, the economy, and the post office. Jacob, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's go back to that date, 2006, because it's a key one here, because I think we need to understand how and why the post office got itself into this, you know, multi-billion dollar hole that it's been virtually impossible to dig out of. So what happened in 2006, Jacob?
Yeah, Meghna, let's go back in time to 2006. The internet is not super mature yet. There is no iPhone. A significant amount of people don't do their business online. And the Postal Service is actually doing pretty well. Mail volume is up. They're making money. And Congress looks at the Postal Service and says, hey, why are we handling a lot of your expenses? Why are taxpayers handling a lot of your expenses when you can do this yourself? And so it assigns expenses for Postal Service retirees and retiree health care back to the mail agency. That sounds great in practice. And then the iPhone comes out, and then the internet gets better, and communication habits change, and the recession hits in late 2007, early 2008. And our communications and mailing habits change. The Postal Service does not generally get money from Congress. It sustains itself from the sale of postage products. And so that legislation in 2006 sets up this funding model for the Postal Service for future expenses that it can't pay over time. Mm-hmm.
But just to reiterate, back in 2006, this is the George W. Bush administration, it seemed to make financial sense to have the post office take on all those liabilities?
Yeah, at the time it does. The Postal Service is profitable. And this is a deal struck between the Bush White House that wants to get certain expenses off the federal ledger to cut the federal budget, and labor-friendly Democrats who want to see the federal government set aside money in advance for unionized workers' retirement. And this was some sort of happy medium. And we're looking at now with this bill and the situation the postal staff currently finds itself in is rectifying a good idea gone wrong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so I was trying to rack my brain to think of, is there any other federal agency which has had to take on its own liabilities in the same way?
That is a great question. The answer to that is no. The Postal Service is unique. But then again, that's why we're here, because everything about the Postal Service is unique. There is no other federal agency that comes to your home 6 or 7 days of the week. There's no other federal agency that really provides a consumer service the way the Postal Service does.
Mm. Okay. And we'll get to that more a little later in the show, because the reform bill seems to acknowledge a lot of that uniqueness. But tell us about sort of what the current financial state prior to Congress passing and Biden signing this bill earlier this year. How dire is the balance sheet of the Postal Service?
Exceedingly, exceedingly dire. And I think the best way to do that is to explore this, is to go back to March 2020 when the pandemic starts and kind of work our way forward. March 2020, the pandemic starts, the economy's doing really poorly, and the Postal Service looks at its balance sheet and says, oh my goodness, we are going to run out of money by the middle of this summer. Congress, you need to do something. That's because the volume of mail that's being sent is down, so it's making less money. Its employee compensation costs are up. And so it keeps going back to Congress saying we need an emergency bailout, we need an emergency bailout. By the time this bill passes, what this does is it relieves $107 billion in past due and future amounts. The Postal Service is staring down a $160 billion loss over the next decade. So, you know, a billion here, a billion there, that's a lot of money at some point. And that's what the Postal Service was looking at.
Wow. Okay. So a dire picture on the financial side of the post office here. And now let's dig in some detail into what the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022 seeks to accomplish. Now, did you just say that, like, there's money involved here, and you might have mentioned it, but remind me, how much are we talking about?
Yeah, there is real money involved here. The Postal Service had $57 billion in a certain type of liabilities that it had no hope of paying off, and that was universally acknowledged. This bill wipes that slate clean. It had another $50 billion coming due over the next 10 years, again, that everyone kind of acknowledged there was no way it was going to be able to pay. It wipes that clean. So it's $107 billion in past due and future amounts. The bill also codifies six-day delivery. It authorizes the Postal Service to contract with local, state, and indigenous governments to offer some different government services, like a hunting license or a fishing license. And it sets some kind of oddly specific regulations on how the Postal Service structures its network. So this bill, when we talk about what the meat and potatoes is, this is a balance sheet adjustment designed to give the Postal Service the financial flexibility to make investments it has not been able to make since 2006.
Is it a one-time balance sheet adjustment, though?
Yeah, it's a one-time balance sheet adjustment. But again, these are expenses that were that stretched out over the next decade and also reached into the past. So we're getting rid of past due amounts, and then there's amounts in the future that stretched over the next 10 years.
Okay. So when you said, though, a specific kind of liability, I mean, I really want to get in the weeds here.
I live in the weeds. Let's do it.
So we're like parting the grasses here. Tell me what those specific kinds of liabilities are.
This is retiree health care benefits. So it's not folks' pensions. It is the reason why this type of liability is important is mail work is a physically taxing job. It is repetitive stress. If you're driving in a truck, reaching out the window to get to every mailbox, it's hauling hampers or crates of mail. It's walking neighborhoods. This is a physically taxing job. It is blue-collar government work, 6 or 7 days a week, long hours, doing the same kind of motions. So when we talk about retiree benefits, the health benefits, not necessarily the pensions or anything else, is the meat and potatoes. That's the ballgame.
Mm. And so then the money then would cover both past due liabilities and then future expectations of what retiree health benefits are going to cost the Postal Service?
That's right, because what this 2006 bill did is it required the Postal Service to set aside money in advance for retirees' health care in a specific acknowledgement that this is physical, taxing work and that workers are going to need this money. To take care of themselves. Again, they are the only federal agency that ever does that. And no one in the private sector would ever do that. It's just not a very good idea.
Right.
At the time in 2006, you know, this passed on voice votes in both houses of Congress. This was universally kind of accepted as a good idea.
Yeah, you know, but you could see the argument for it though, because I'm thinking of other situations of states and municipalities say that have essentially now unfunded mandates for retiree health benefits for government workers at state and at the state and local level. Like that, those are major costs that they don't know how to pay for. So the idea was to avoid that with the Postal Service. But I note that the bill then doesn't take the responsibility for paying for retiree health care benefits off the Postal Service's books entirely. So we're going to talk about that more when we come back. We're looking into the fact that Congress and the Biden administration have tried or are trying to put the Postal Service on a better financial footing. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the United States Postal Service, and specifically a bill passed earlier this year and signed by President Joe Biden. It's called the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022, and it's designed to put the post office, or the Postal Service, on stronger financial footing. It's a solution that Congress has offered and the president has signed, and we're trying to understand it today to see how much it does help the post office and what it remains to be done to keep America's favorite federal agency, according to Gallup, as strong and reliable as possible. And by the way, would love to hear what you think about congressional efforts to help the Postal Service. Hop on social media, on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. I'm joined today by Jacob Bogage. He's reporter for The Washington Post. He covers business, the economy, and the U.S. Postal Service. And joining us now is Paul Steidler. He's a senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. They research, study, and discuss logistics and energy issues, also focused on solutions they think should come from the private sector rather than government. And he addresses the financial and operational policies of the U.S. Postal Service. So, Paul Steidler, welcome to you.
It's great to be here.
So give me your overall sort of rating on the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022. Is it a good bill that will help the post office?
It's not a good bill, and it's a blown opportunity. While the measure has some good features in there, it really comes down to being a 3 on a scale of about 1 to 10. There's no question that some of the healthcare liabilities needed to be wiped out from the Postal Service, but they didn't need to be wiped out this year. The Postal Service has more than $20 billion in cash. So it is structurally losing money. It structurally has, as Jacob pointed out, very severe long-term liabilities. But it was not in danger of immediately shutting down. And in fact, the pandemic gave it a shot in the arm because the pandemic was very good for its package business and actually gave it a little bump financially. What's disappointing about this bill is that some fundamental major issues were not addressed. The quality of mail service has slowed very significantly over the past 7 years, and the Postmaster General, starting in October of 2021, lowered the delivery time of 40% of first-class mail by an additional day. That's something that Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, completely overlooked as part of this legislation. Secondly, the Postal Service from 1970, when there was major legislation enacted, to 2006, was largely self-supporting. It was able to cover its cost from its own revenues, though it had not addressed the looming health care costs, and that was the retiree health care costs. And that was the rationale for the change in the 2006 Act. It's not at all clear that Congress wants to keep that in place. There was just a $3 billion subsidy that went in place for electric vehicles. The Postmaster General is seeking $14 billion of an actuarial adjustment that's going to cut that. And that's real money. That comes from other parts of the Treasury. Also, the obligations for postal workers did not go away here on retiree health care costs. Some of them are going to pay more money because they're required to be in Medicare. And the Postal Service still has high costs of its own that have to be addressed. The Postmaster General, at a public meeting on August the 9th, voiced concern about these costs and the fact that they're going to be something like $6 billion in the coming years. There was also no definition of the Postal Service's mission. The Postal Service has a public service duty to deliver mail. Yet what it's increasingly been doing is turning to packages. There's a lot of options that people have for packages. And frankly, many of the things that people get by packages are far less important than the payments, the legal documents, and other business information that still comes by mail. There's still 110 billion pieces of mail, both marketing mail and first-class correspondence that comes every year. Also, the legislation did not strengthen its regulator, and it took a complete pass at holding the Postal Service accountable for better understanding its costs on a per-product basis, something that its Office of Inspector General has been calling on it to do since 2014. Basically, if they institute what's known as a greenfield, modern, bottom-up costing and revenue measurement system, that's going to enable them to price and redeploy resources more effectively. That's getting into the weeds on things, but there are blown opportunities here, and Congress is just not likely to come around and address these issues for years, maybe even a decade.
So, Paul, if I may, can I summarize your evaluation of the new Reform Act as you give it an F?
I'd give it a D.
A D minus. 3 out of 10 in my book is an F, but I guess you're being generous with your D minus there. Okay, so
we won't get into the public school standards changing. But agreed.
So let's dig into this here because while you know the incisive criticism I appreciate, I also just want to understand in more detail. Why? Because perhaps in listening to your list here, Paul, I just wonder if you're also expecting too much of Congress or more than they're able to deliver in one fell swoop. So let's just go through some of the specific points you made. And Jacob, I'd love to get your impressions, too. But first of all, Paul, when you said that those obligations, the certain, like really the cost-driving obligations are not going away, tell me more. Do you see that as the healthcare costs or what?
Well, yes, the Postal Service is legally required to have a very generous retiree health care benefits program. That's part of the 1970 legislation. That stayed intact as part of what's put forward here. So unlike a corporation, the Postal Service can't decide it's going to eliminate this program. So the program has stayed in place, but because workers at the Postal Service, when they retire, those who are retiring must first go into Medicare. They're going to be compelled to go into for many of them is going to be a service that's more expensive and less attractive than what they had previously. So that's one area where the costs have gone. Another area is the costs are just big in general. I mean, Medicare has to pay out added costs for this. And while there's a deferral in what the Postal Service has to pay in, those costs are still very high, as the Postmaster General specifically mentioned on August the 9th.
Mm. Well, so Jacob, let me turn back to you here, because this brings me back to the question I sort of rhetorically asked at the end of the previous segment, that you laid out all the good reasons for the need for quality retiree health care amongst postal workers here. But if providing that is a major cause of the financial pain that the post office is enduring or experiencing, why not just take this opportunity to take it off the liabilities of the USPS?
That's a great question. And I think that's something that liberals and Democrats would love. And Paul and I have spent hours talking about this because I'll call him up and ask him that question. And he'll go, well, do you want the short answer or the long answer? I think that's a great question. I think it speaks to the nature of postal service in this country, which is this is an agency that is set up to run more like a private company that happens to be owned by the government than a government service. Mm-hmm. I think an analog to that would be Amtrak, potentially. This is a corporation that is owned by the government, and therefore the federal government at some point said, well, not at some point in 1970, said, you need to take care of your own house. Now, is that a realistic expectation for how we want government service to operate in this country? You know, that is a perfectly fair question to ask. I think Paul and his research would say no. I think there are other folks who would say yes.
Paul, I mean, go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah.
So a couple of things, Meghna. First and foremost, postal workers should be well paid and they should have generous retiree health care benefits. But if you take a look at this, you see a classic way in which Congress failed. You know, police, firemen, teachers, the state pension plans that they have invest in a diversified mix of stock and bond options. By law, the Postal Service's retiree health benefits program and its pension benefits are only invested in government bonds, which since 2006 have gotten a paltry 2-3% return a year. Now, we all know the stock market's been in the tank this year, but if you were setting up an investment portfolio today, you would not allocate all of your money to government bonds, especially at these interest rates. And if you want to talk about something that should have been a hallmark of substantial reform here, it would have been transitioning to an investment system that allows the Postal Service to invest like the Teachers Fund of California, the Government Workers Fund of New York. And if that had been done in 2006, the Postal Service would have been fat and happy. It would have been covering all of its retiree health care benefit obligations. Its people would be making more, and all types of good things would be going on. Mm. The problem with this bill, the central problem with it, is nobody wanted to do something that was unpopular. And that was made very clear by people who were leading the push for this in the House and Senate. They were not going to put anything in that was going to be controversial, like electric vehicle funding or other things along those lines. And that's not how legislation should work. Legislation should involve things, and I'm old enough to have experienced this, that are going to be unpleasant to both sides, but you take it because it's in the best public good. Mm. This just put all the soft stuff in. It ignored things like investment reforms, cost accounting measures, improving mail system, and holding the Postal Service accountable for that.
Magna, if I could.
Yeah, go ahead.
Paul makes a great point about the investment reforms, because that is incentive for Congress to not change it. I talk to postal officials all the time who say, we basically make interest-free loans to the Treasury every year. When we make, you know, when we make our investments in the Treasury and we get back 2 or 3%, we're basically making them low interest loans every year. And with, you know, how everyone likes to talk about the deficit and things like that, regardless of what kind of tax legislation Congress passes, there is incentive here to keep that revenue flowing in and to use the Postal Service as a hobby horse for Congress. Yeah. And they are not opposed to doing that.
Mm. You know, I actually really, I want to even get deeper than just in the weeds. I want to get down to the roots here, okay?
Oh, boy. Magda.
No, but because what I'm hearing is, both of you are describing some fundamental structural problems with the United States Postal Service. But in my mind, you know, structural problems don't just happen organically. They are created. they are structurally crafted. Maybe they weren't intended to be problems in the beginning, but that's what they turn out to be. So why I point that out is what's at the root here, if I'm understanding both of you correctly, is still there's no change in the notion that the Postal Service in the long run needs to be a self-funding agency. Is one of the biggest missed opportunities in the Reform Act that maybe that notion should have been changed? I mean, why not actually acknowledge that the Postal Service is providing a service to every American household, literally every American household in this country, that perhaps cannot be fully self-funded, but it is such a public service that we shouldn't expect it to be self-funded. Paul?
Well, Magna, I think you've hit on a great point. And to reiterate, the Postal Service was self-funded from 1970 to 2006. If you think about it, the delivery of mail and packages is something that, if there's any area of government, and the Postal Service is 100% part of the federal government, if there's any part of the government that should be able to balance its budgets, it's the distribution of mail and packages. It certainly worked well on the mail front. But the difficulty that comes into play here is there are, frankly, a lot of people who want the Postal Service to do things other than deliver mail and packages. There's been a significant reduction in mail volume by approximately 40% over the past decade. And that has led the Postal Service to rush out and to seek to do package delivery. There are some packages where it's in the public interest for the Postal Service to deliver them. I mean, medicines from the VA, for example. But while people rely on the Postal Service exclusively for mail, you know, if I want to order a new razor from Walmart because I'm very specific about the razor that I need, I don't need a subsidy for that. Walmart doesn't need a subsidy for that. There are other options for that that are out there. But at the same time, you have, people are looking at the reduction in mail volume, which is still the brunt of the volume that the Postal Service has, there's all types of ideas being floated for the Postal Service to get into things like checking on the elderly, fresh food delivery, things along those lines.
But don't doesn't the Postal Service need those ideas because the fundamental cost basis for the Postal Service doesn't change no matter what they're delivering because their mandate is to be able to reach every American home, right? So, like, they could be delivering one piece of mail, or they could be delivering 27 billion pieces of mail. It doesn't matter. They still have to have a system in place to reach every American home. So if they're going to have to be self-funded and the volume of mail delivery is going down, they've got to find other ways to make up the difference in order to continue doing the service that they're required to do.
I would agree with you on that, but the volume of mail is still quite high. There's 110 billion pieces of mail in the country that are still being delivered, and it's going to stay high. It may continue to decline, but it's going to stay high. And in certain areas, like greeting cards, mail volume is growing because it's more decent to send someone a condolence, you know, via greeting card, for example, than to say hashtag so sad about your loss. So the other thing is you have to be careful about what you have the Postal Service take on. Mm. The Postmaster General has pointed out that 500,000 pieces of mail can fill a tractor trailer, but 5,000 packages can fill that tractor trailer. So what packages leads to is a lot more back and forth to postal services to deliver. On a size basis, they're less cost effective. And, you know, you can have somebody go out in one day and deliver tens of thousands of dollars worth of mail, whereas for packages, they got to come back several times.
Well, Paul Steidler and Jacob Bogage, stand by for just a minute. We're going to talk a lot more about what needs to be done to protect the U.S. Postal Service for the long run when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about a bill passed earlier this year by Congress and signed by President Joe Biden, the Postal Service Reform Act of 2022. It's a solution that's been put forth by the federal government to help shore up the United States Postal Service, and we're trying to understand what the Reform Act accomplishes, what it doesn't, and what's needed to strengthen your local post office into the future. I'm joined today by Paul Steidler. He's a senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. Jacob Bogage joins us as well. He's a reporter at the Washington Post, covers business, the economy, and the Postal Service as well. And gentlemen, as you may not be shocked to hear, we're getting a lot of response on social media because people love their post office. And I want to read some of this because ultimately, I mean, we can smile, but these are the people that the post office is serving. And it's important to understand what they think about the congressional attempts to shore up the post office. So Alice says, can we please hone in on the fact that it is mentioned as a postal service and services cost money, and that's okay and good. The fact that the USPS recoups any costs should be the cherry on top of the cake. That is every important and even life-sustaining service they provide. Okay, so then on the same thread, we have Daniel who says, honestly, why the obsession with the post office having to break even? The mail isn't just a service we use. It's a public good that connects people to society and helps our nation function. And then there's this from Charlie Key who says, no one expects the Defense Department, the Commerce Department, or any others to make a profit. So why is the Postal Service the exception? Is it a public service established by the Constitution? No, so sorry, he didn't ask the question. Charlie says, it is a public service established by the Constitution, not an amendment, but in the original document. So Jacob, can I just turn to you quickly for one thing? Because yes. Charlie mentioned the Defense Department, the defense budget is my absolute favorite hobby horse in the world. And I just note, and you can tell me, hey, no, Meghna, this doesn't count. Totally apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. But about expectations, like, you know, the Pentagon continually fails its own audits, right? And they have a budget north of $750 billion. They can't even account for everything they have. But, you know, Congress is like, eh, okay. But on the other hand, as the listeners are pointing out, we still have this expectation that the U.S. Postal Service has to, you know, hold its own. Maybe it's not a fair comparison, but it gets back down to, you know, how do we perceive what the essential services of these various agencies are, and why do we put certain responsibilities on some that we don't put on others? And I just was wondering if you wanted to chime in more on that.
Well, I'll do you one better. In the horrible, unimaginable hypothetical of some sort of nuclear attack, the Postal Service is part of our national defense system. Postal workers are supposed to go door to door and drop off iodine tablets so that we don't get radiation poisoning. I mean, we saw what the Postal Service did during the pandemic, actually just wrapped up this past Friday, in terms of COVID test kits that you could order from the government. They would show up at your home. That is a homeland security prerogative. So, you know, when we talk about the Postal Service and the expectations we have for it, this is why I love covering the Postal Service, because and I like to tell people I write about the Postal Service, I don't write about the mail, because the conversations that we have about this agency are the same conversations we have about every other part of our government. How big is it? How involved should it be in our lives? What services should it offer? What costs should we, the taxpayer, cover? And should it make up for itself? These are all the same conversations we have about every other government agency. But because the Postal Service provides a product that is comparable or in the same neighborhood to other highly successful private sector competitors, Amazon, FedEx, UPS, DHL, so on and so forth, there is a reasonable conversation to be had about how it expects to cover its own costs. Mm. On top of that, it has also done so previously. And when the nature of our society changes, you have to look at your government and say, how should our government change? Should our government change to be more involved in our lives? Should our government change to alter its responsibilities so it does less for us? These are the same kinds of conversations we have about every other government agency and program, from the local to the state to the federal level. Okay. This is why I love the Postal Service so much.
Well, so Paul, let me turn back to you here, because you're at the Lexington Institute, and for transparency's sake, I should say that the Lexington Institute states, as part of its own mission, in limiting the role of the federal government to those functions explicitly stated or implicitly defined in the Constitution, and leaving the rest to non-governmental or market-based solutions. Now, the post office is in the Constitution, but I'm just wondering if your view is that there is, I mean, let me just raise the privatization monster here. What is your view on how the Postal Service should be considered or how it should be focused?
Well, Meghna, thank you for asking that. The Lexington Institute does not, and I repeat, does not believe the Postal Service should be privatized. It is mentioned in the Constitution, as you say. It does provide and has provided for more than 240 years a public service with respect to mail and periodicals delivery. That said, it is common sense to define what the mission of the Postal Service should be going forward here. I'd also just like to point out from the earlier discussion about the Postal Service balancing its books, if you will, the Postal Service hasn't done that since 2016. Mm. It's lost approximately $140 billion over the past 15 plus years. It's not on track to do that this fiscal year, probably won't be next fiscal year. And it is continuing to get a bevy of assistance, not only from the Postal Service Reform Act that the president signed, but it got $10 billion as part of the COVID bailout. Mm. It got $3 plus billion as part of the electrification bill. It has received, it is pursuing other money to alleviate its pension problems. And by the way, the Postal Service has defaulted in over $14 billion of Postal Service of pension payments at the end of fiscal year 2021. So that's another area that was overlooked by the legislation that passed and was enacted in April. But the Postal Service should be part of the federal government. It should also have a clearly defined mission. And having it go into all types of areas outside what it's traditionally done, those have to be looked at very, very carefully.
But how is it? But can I just ask how? But Paul, I'm still not clear on something. How is the Postal Service supposed to sustain itself if it can't find new ways to bring in revenue? You keep talking about all these other areas outside of its clearly defined mission of delivering the mail. But like, let's just say, let's do a thought exercise here for a minute.
Sure.
If it were a truly like private corporation, right, and it was facing stiff competition in the core product that it offered to people, you know, a private company would respond by either, I guess, improving that product and making it more attractive to consumers, or by branching out and into other areas to sustain its business. So why do you keep saying that the Postal Service shouldn't be branching out?
Well, the Postal Service, first of all, could be charging more money to existing customers, which it is doing on the mail front. It's also doing that on the package front here. And I would just point out that there is ample room on the package front for the Postal Service to get more funds coming in. I mean, I use the example of the razors that I'm ordering from Walmart. It is still going to be, even if that price increases 20-30%, it's still going to be more advantageous for me to get them than to drive to three or four stores to get the specific razors that I obsess over. I can afford it. Walmart can afford it. And to get to that, the Postal Service, and I go back to the words of this 2014 Office of Inspector General study, the Postal Service would benefit significantly from a greenfield modern bottom-up costing and revenue analysis system. It has to do a lot of rote routine work here, understanding its costs better. It has to vastly overhaul its technology systems, have better data analytics, and to be able to better pinpoint where it should be charging more, and in some cases, charging less for essential products.
Yeah, Jake, let me turn back to you here on this, because on areas that it should be charging more, we have Janet Jameson, who sent us this message on Facebook, that says junk mail makes up a large portion of today's deliveries, and those mailers pay pennies. Regular folks pay full boat for a stamp. It's time to raise costs for bulk mailers. They've had it too cheap for too long. Jacob, what do you think?
So I want to just touch on one thing that you mentioned earlier, but it'll be very quick, and
okay.
I promise I'll get to the other thing.
Sure.
So you mentioned three options that a business would do if it needed to compete. One, improve its product. Two, create other products to bring in more revenue. There is a third option, and that is get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
That is focus on the thing that makes you money. And packages bring in more revenue for the Postal Service, but mail is more profitable for the Postal Service. There is a higher return on investment. So that is one solution that I think some folks explore. So, and then, okay, so the question from our wonderful listener about pricing. There is a fundamental issue here, and that's the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. It is very difficult, in fact, illegal, to charge different mail products different prices, specifically based on the content of the message. The other thing is the way that junk mailers, let's call them mass mailers because they're an important part of the ecosystem. Mass mailers send out their products is through a different postage product that charges less because delivery doesn't have to be as timely, or they can do what's called injecting it further into the postal system, saving the Postal Service a lot of work. So there are good reasons to do all of that. And the Postmaster General Louis DeJoy cares a lot about pricing. Stamp prices are going up. They're going up twice a year for a whole lot of years. That's not just tied to inflation. That's because it costs a lot less to send a letter in the United States than it does literally anywhere else in the world. So there is money to be made off of consumers. The concern, and businesses that use the mail system, the concern is how much more can you raise that price before folks say, I can just do this online anyway. Mm.
Since we've mentioned the Postmaster General several times, we have another question that's come in. And Jacob, I'm going to give this one to you again. Why is Louis DeJoy still in charge? Renee wants to know. It seems that the removal of someone bent on dismantling the post office would be a good first step. Jacob.
That's an existential question. Why is he still in charge? I can tell you. I guess let's work backwards here. Is he bent on dismantling the Postal Service? No, he's not. And I talked to him last week to set up a story we're working on. I mean, this is someone who is committed to a public post office. He knows what he's talking about in terms of logistics. Are there policies that folks disagree with him about? Absolutely. And there are honest disagreements there about what the scope of the Postal Service should be and the services it should offer at the price it should offer it. Is that dismantling the Postal Service? I would take issue with that characterization. Two, the governing framework that keeps him in office. The Postal Service is run by a 9-member board of governors. Those are folks appointed by the president, confirmed by the U.S. Senate. It takes a supermajority of that 9, so 6 members, to remove a sitting postmaster general. There is not sufficient support on the board to remove him. Mm.
Well, we're rounding towards the end of today's conversation, and I just want to bring it back down to the level of the people whom the United States Postal Service serves. And one thing that the post office will always have, at least hopefully, is presence, physical presence in communities. So Paul, while I hear you about refining and specifying the Postal Service's mission and maybe not having it do things outside of that mission, I wonder about, because Jacob had mentioned, I think, under consideration of, like, could the post office be a place where you got your hunting or fishing license or what have you, even postal banking. There is actually great value to having an agency that's physically located in almost every single community in the United States. It can provide services that perhaps aren't exclusively limited to delivering the mail, Paul.
Yes. Well, back in the last decade, around 2012, 2013, there was a big push to close down and consolidate the number of post offices, the things that people actually walk into to transact business. There is no support in Congress for that to take place, and that fight has already taken place. So with very few exceptions, you're going to have all the postal services in the U.S. which are now open, staying open, and that's a good thing because that connects the country together, especially in smaller, more rural communities. That fight is over. There is going to be no appetite at the Postal Service, although if they had their druthers, they'd probably push for it, or in Congress to go forward with that. I'd also just like to make a point about the Postmaster General to the earlier question. We at the Lexington Institute vigorously disagree with the Postmaster General on many of his policies. But if you look at how he has conducted himself since coming into office, he has really functioned as a statesman. He has taken an awful lot of guff from an awful lot of people, and there is no way this Postal Service Reform Act would have been passed if he had not been at the center of working with people like Josh Hawley and Tom Tillis of North Carolina to get it enacted. He also oversaw the election in 2020 when mail-in voting occurred, and he's someone who's going to be an honest broker as far as the election and other things go going forward here. We wish he'd change some of his policies, but for someone who gets an awful lot of guff, he does get a lot accomplished.
Well, Paul Steidler, fellow at the Lexington Institute, thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Jacob Bogage at The Washington Post. Jacob, it was great to have you. Thank you as well.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.